Hello, welcome back to the David Watson podcast. Today I spoke with Christopher, and Christopher is a former naval man, 28 years, and he's written a sci-fi book. So you've got this wonderful blend of operational experience with a sci-fi drama. And you know this, anybody who loves their sci-fi, anybody who loves the concept of aliens, what is out in space, he answers the question in his book, what would happen when the military might of the Earth meets up for the first time with an alien species, alien force, an alien culture? We don't know yet, do we? We haven't got into the depths of the book of who and what they are and how we respond. But he does do a great breakdown of all the dilemmas he had to cover, how he covers them and why. And sometimes how these were experiences extracted from his real life. I really enjoyed talking to him. I hope you like listening. Let me know what you think. Hello, welcome to the David Watson podcast. Thank you very much for joining me. How are you doing today?
Good, thank you. I appreciate the time and to be on the show.
I know, I appreciate you coming on. And you and I just literally had 30 seconds of conversation before I started recording. And I almost stopped you mid-conversation because you said something and I was like, I don't want to know about it right now. I need to ask you this question. What was it you just said to me?
For my second novel, I just received the publication clearance from the Department of Defense.
So you're going to have to explain to me why this is.
28 years in the military, I have to send everything I'm sending to publication first through Department of Defense to get their permission to publish. And they literally sent this to me within like the last half hour, stating my manuscript submitted for pre-publication security review is cleared for public release. Of course, they want me to put in two disclaimers in the book that they don't endorse it or talk about the accuracy of anything in the book.
So
being science fiction, that's fine.
So even if your book isn't military related, defense related, do you know what I mean? There's no way in you know, you could be like, if you were doing a book on gardening, would you still have to actually submit it because of your history?
Yes.
So I love that. I honestly love that. That's like, for the rest of your life, you so much as write an article in the newspaper, we want to see it first.
Yeah, actually I need to send them a article I sent in for a review, a short story that I'm doing about a futuristic fighter pilot that has to crash land on a planet. So I really ought to send that in as well, since it's supposed to come out in a few. But yeah, with SESG Explorer, my first novel, I actually had to send that as well to the Department of Defense for review.
So the 10-year-old in my head is running away with his imagination right now. And and we are going to talk about SESG Explorer, I promise you. I promise you. Does that mean there's just by some pure chance that you're writing the next novel, the next idea, that you come up with something that's just a little bit too close to maybe something they're working on? No coincidence that people might start knocking on the door saying, we need to have a long chat with you about this. If you just happen to describe something that there's somebody might be working on.
It's interesting because after 9/11, I did have an NCIS agent show up in my office on board the ship I was on to talk to me about certain vulnerabilities And I'm going to dance around it a
Yeah, of
little
course.
bit because in a exercise, I came up with the tactic that I was told was ridiculous and just really out there. And suddenly, after 9/11, here I am being asked questions about things that related to that idea. So,
So
short
something you were
answer
once
would
mocked
be.
for, somebody's like, "Oh, we need to have a chat with you about this long-standing joke you presented."
Right. So yeah, somebody could possibly give me a phone call or show up flashing a badge going, "May we talk?"
Yeah. That is it's quite fascinating. That is quite fascinating. And now moving on to the actual reason that you and I are talking, SESG Explorer. What made you go for sci-fi?
Well, years ago, as growing up, my desire for sci-fi was awakened by my dad's collection of 1950s old novels on, science fiction, and then, of course, Robert A. Heinlein, follow on by Isaac Asimov. All those books just really woke up the imagination about space or the future, or, and then, of course, fantasy comes along with J.R.R. Tolkien, C.S.
Yeah.
Lewis, among Stephen R. Donaldson. So all those writers of the past and even current really stoked the imagination. And when I wrote SESG Explorer, it was during my time in Iraq in 2006. On my downtime, I would write the book, and I wanted to highlight the Navy Marine Corps team. And doing that in the real world could create problems, country X, country Y, this mission or that mission. But making it futuristic, where they're going out into space to meet aliens, that's a safe realm. I can highlight the military without talking about anything that I was working on or had been working on. And of course, it had to translate since I retired from the Navy. Being a Navy officer, I had to change it from Navy Marine Corps to really the US military because my experience went to unified commands where I worked with different services, the Air Force and the Army, and not just the Navy and Marines. And then Space Force was created. So I had to revamp the entire book to include Space Force and my characters outside of my main character. I had to revamp their service history. Some of them came from the Air Force. Some of them were part of Space Force from the get-go and from the Navy because the setting takes place about 20 years from now, or about 18 now. So people in Space Force could legitimately have started in another service and transferred into Space Force by this time.
Okay, yeah. So,
So,
go on.
yeah.
Okay. No,
No, I that again, it's just to highlight the military
yeah.
in the futuristic setting.
Because I've always had this theory when, when people say, like, do aliens exist? I've always had this theory that it's unlikely they don't, because the universe is just too huge. That the probability we are the only thing that ever evolves out of the trillions of solar systems out there is that's actually what's almost impossible. So the only concepts we have to concern ourselves with are the first one is what level of technology do they have? Because the chances are, if we haven't met them, that there's a 50-50 chance the technology just doesn't exist for them as it doesn't for us. For that sort of technology to exist, you would have to imagine, say, an Earth-like planet. You'd have to imagine that they all cooperated and worked together. So in one sense, they're either peaceful or dictatorial. So they either somebody took over the entire planet, or the entire planet learned to live together, right, and cooperate together. Right. Which isn't, it's not impossible. You know, that there's no reason why that's not possible. So our only concern is, if they have the technology, are they doing kind of like the Star Trek Vulcan type thing, where you have some form of federation where they don't get involved until you reach a level of technology? Or is it just, no, they're slowly working their way through universe by universe, solar system by solar system. It's basically taking everything they want because they can. And eventually they'll catch us and we'll be enslaved.
Right. So there's so many variables to that. And the U.S. Book of Review, or U.S. Review of Books, actually likened the novel to a military-minded Star Trek, in that, we come across a message from deep space.
Yeah.
And gaps in the message with technology, which causes our political leaders to wonder, why are there gaps? If they're sending out a message to make contact, but they're leaving out gaps, what's their motivation? What's their objective? And that's why we send out a fleet rather than just responding to the message, because our own scientists already had the hyperspace drive with gaps in their knowledge. And it just happened that, and call it circumstance, call it the writer's prerogative, the Camorrigan's message, that's the name of the species that sent it, fills in our gaps. And our technology level fills in the missing gaps, so we could develop the hyperspace drive. The other factor that you brought up, I mean, kind of two schools of thought, and I think it's really just, you can say, well, there's other schools within it, but one, we are alone in the universe, which a lot of people would say, but I've had encounters. But Dr. Frank Drake, back in the early 60s, came up with an equation. And the University of Nottingham, I came across this, and Professor Constalese, they determined something like, they estimate through this equation, there's 30 and maybe a little bit more civilizations out there that are sentient beings. And they make a key assumption: their tech level is at the same level as ours.
Okay.
And therefore, we have not actually contacted each other. And yet, you know, here you have different hearings in our Congress, as well as people who say they've had encounters. So how do they work that out? Are they contradicting each other, or is there a paradox there? I assume, in SCSG Explorer, the Admiral, they come across a slave market at this one space station. And it's really disappointing to them that exists out in the wider galaxy, because my personal experience, I've encountered the slave market on our world. And so it's part of my characters that, you know, here they've encountered this, and it creates a moral dilemma for them. What do they do about it? And the Admiral, my main character, he actually gets upset about thinking these alien encounters back on Earth, how many of them were plucking up humans to put into such a horrible situation. It's bad enough we do it to ourselves.
But it's an unfortunate reality that often isn't discussed, that people, I think a lot of people don't realize the slave trade isn't over in this country, planet, and that it still exists. If you go to the right countries and to the right areas of those countries, there is an existing slave trade where human beings are still traded and bought as slaves. It hasn't, despite what, without getting too political, mainstream media will tell you, it's still out there and it's rife and people know it exists and they know what countries it exists in.
Well, sadly, I mean, it even exists in our country. Our own State Department of the United Nations has identified it within our own country.
Mm.
And
I wasn't actually going to mention that you're one of the countries that's listed as the highest for sex slaves and underage children.
Well, and
you know
it's
what?
an ugly reality that I would rather have a conversation about in order to stop it.
Oh yeah, no. So I didn't want that to come across as like as a derogative as it came out. It's not what I meant.
No,
it's just this.
Take it that way.
Yeah, it's just no, but it's just highlighting that people have this world view of what the world is like, and it's like, no, actually, hang on a second. You know, the there are countries out there that have a thriving business in slavery and underage sex slaves particularly, and America is one of the that people don't realize is one of the thriving areas for that. And for sex trafficking, for smuggling humans, and they come from around the globe. It's not people like you can't point a finger in one single area. It's like no. Unfortunately and sadly, it's a global industry. And I don't for one second think that it's not happening in the UK. It's just we're a tiny country, so percentage wise, we don't register much.
And no, I understand. And my biggest thing is, and even my wife, when she read the book, she goes, "You really have an issue about this." And
yeah,
I'm
yeah.
Like, well, yeah, it exists. And we need to be proactive in stopping it. Not, you know, in our individual countries first and globally secondly. You know, however you want to, so to speak, skin the cat. You need to start skinning the cat.
It's an interesting one. I remember watching and we're going a bit off topic here, but we'll just run with it for a bit because, and the reason I say it's interesting because it made me think about it. And there was a documentary some years ago by a chap called Ross Kemp who did various documentaries about gangs around the world. And this guy was talking about the Middle East, particularly when Gaddafi fell and Saddam Hussein fell and stuff like that. And they were largely responsible for stopping migrants coming across those Middle Eastern countries and making their way to the Mediterranean. But at the same time, all of these tribal leaders lost their commerce that was provided by either Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi. They controlled the company, right. The country, and controlled the way that they could make money and businesses they could have and et cetera, et cetera. And of course all of that infrastructure collapsed, so they had to become self-sustaining. Human sex trafficking was the best way to become self-sustaining, but suddenly the borders went down and all of these migrants were trying to cross. It's like, well, you now belong to me because you've walked into my town, and
right.
you start to realize that these people just they live in a world that we don't, well, I say we, I don't understand, because they're looking at another human being and it's not a human being, it's a commodity. You are a property that I can take. You're not a human, you're not a person, you're not male, you're not female, you are a price. And I know exactly how much you're worth. And I know what your assets are, what your value is, and now you belong to me because you wandered into my town.
Right. Well, and that actually relates back to SCSG Explorer, in that it's given away right off the bat that even though the humans send out a fleet for trade and diplomatic relations, that's not what the Kevorkians want.
Yeah.
And they discover this through their interaction with them. And for the Admiral and his fleet, it becomes a fight for survival. Because they also encounter another alien on the homeworld of the Kevorkians that is enslaved by them, and his people and his world was enslaved by the Kevorkians. So it is, back to your first proposition, is this a intelligent force that's solar hopping to just get more resources and control,
Benevolent and kind.
or are they benevolent? And if there are contact with aliens with our people, why are they contacting us? What's their objective, their goal? And why are we talking to them? What are we getting out of it? And which governments are, I only hear really about the US government with any form of alien interaction. Well, why is the US so special?
When you just mentioned that, you suddenly realize just how much governments around the world don't trust each other. Because, like you say, we only ever hear about the American government, and that's true. I've never heard any other government talking about aliens, and I know for a fact, because I've been in members of these Facebook groups, I've heard people talk, everybody talks about alien abductions in every country you go to. And you're just like, oh. But none of our governments talk to each other about it, which makes you think maybe one of them does have them in their pocket and they're just not sharing that info.
Well, and that's kind of, I mean, I used obviously our planet's history and government relations in the book and how the crew encounters different groups of people on their way to the Camorgan homeworld and how they have to contend with that. They're going out peacefully. They're a big military might, but they're really on a diplomatic mission. And the admiral, when he got assigned to the mission, demanded a diplomat to be placed on his staff, his own staff, not part of the crew, but his staff, with a small diplomat corps, because he wanted diplomacy. But in the end, it turns out he needed the military might behind him. And
It's interesting because I was watching a podcast yesterday with a guy who was a historian of Sir Winston Churchill, and he was talking about in the build up to because Sir Winston Churchill served in the Boer War and the First World War, and saw action and stuff like that, and he in the build up to the First World the Second World War, he had been highly critical of Stalin. And publicly critical of Stalin. And then, of course, with the Second World War, Chamberlain stood down and Winston Churchill took over and became the World War II Prime Minister that everybody knows. But he had to reconcile himself with who Stalin was and how much he disagreed with Stalin. So this historian was talking about Sir Winston Churchill had to be pragmatic about who his allies were. He then had to somehow reconcile with the Polish who were at war, who had been at war with Russia and the Soviet Union because of the First World War and the assassination. I think it was the assassination of one of their leading members of their government. I think that's, if I might, history might be skewed there slightly. And of course, but he wanted to ally with the Soviet Union, but between him and the Soviet Union was Poland. And he had to negotiate with Poland, who were also at war with Germany, but were quite happy to go to war again with Russia. It's like, actually, we need these guys. And I don't agree with them either. And it was a real conflict. It was a really big conflict.
And SCSG Explorer focuses more on just the US because they hide this message from the rest of the world. And they do a cover story about the fleet. But the trilogy, this is the first book in a trilogy. And this letter I just received is about the second book, Minerva. In that, you're going to see more of that political dance because Earth can't do this by itself. It becomes a galactic conflict that they're now involved in, and they have to find allies. We kind of discover along the way what that means or may mean. And So it is based off of how do you have an alliance or a coalition? What are you, an idealist or are you pragmatic? Part of my issues, and I kind of explored a little bit in SESG Explorer, but it's really in the trilogy, realism versus idealism. The United States is an idealistic country, and we're driven by idealism, whereas Russia and China, even the Soviet Union, were realist countries, pragmatic in their approach to things. They're also a zero-sum country. If both of you are winning, they view themselves as losing. They're only winning if the other side's losing too. So
I've had
I
similar
took them.
conversations with friends because I've worked with Russians. I dated a Russian. I've been to Moscow 5 times, and I haven't been back there since 2011. But I worked it on an engineering project back in the early noughties for Shell, and on which was based off the island of Sakhalin, and we were based in London, which is Eastern Siberian Russia, I think. And we worked alongside their ex-naval engineers, so their idea of engineering and our idea of engineering was completely different. Like, they wanted like 4-inch fixed steel plate for helicopter pads, and we're like, "What for? Well, what if somebody tries to take it down?" "Well, t what do you mean take it down?" "Well, somebody might be like an air to air missile or some air to group." It's like, no. We're not building defense systems. It's an oil. It's a helicopter pad for an oil platform." But their brain was, "Well, what if somebody fires at it?" You know what I mean? Because that's everything they had engineered. And they wanted this big fixed steel plate. And everyone else is trying to reduce the weight of this thing. Already weighs like 1 billion tons. And you're like, "Cool, we don't think it's strong enough. What if somebody, comes along with a rocket launcher and tries to take out a helicopter?" And we're like, "Who would do that in the middle of nowhere in an ice region?" But that was their thinking. That was the way they were trained. That was the way they were educated. And they had a, like you said, they were very pragmatic about everything. Almost nothing was taken personally. It's just, okay, this is what it has to be. This is what we do. And we're like, and there was no negotiations about feelings, ideas. It's just like everything was square boxes, round holes. That was it.
Indeed, and that's why in negotiating, to me, it's hard to negotiate. Well, for me, it's easy to negotiate against a realist, vice an idealist. Yes, I can figure out more your value system and what it is that you value. An idealist, you really have to get deep into their mind to get that value system. And I touch on it a little bit in the book when the admiral and the diplomat Michael Shea is negotiating with the Comoricans about trade. Because the Comoricans keep harping for one piece of information that the admiral will not give, and that's the general order that he was given by his leadership. Never let Earth's location be known. Protect, and he actually creates a border away from Earth and establishes that no one can get to Earth without first going to this one location. And in the end, they don't want anyone leaving that location to travel on to Earth. So.
It's difficult, isn't it? It's, when you said about the realist versus the idealist, I remember this saying that I was told when I was in Moscow, and it was a conversation, allegedly, and it probably never happened, like all anecdotes that they exaggerated from another place, but that you had a British diplomat and a Russian diplomat, and the British diplomat was saying to the Russian diplomat, "The problem we've got is that your country is too corrupt." And the Russian diplomat replied, "We're no more corrupt than you. We're just honest about it."
And no, that's a, it's a way of holding up a mirror to a person, because really, if you get the idea you're above corruption, and yet, what's the old axiom? Power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So if you're in power long enough, you're going to do the things that you hate in the end. Well, when you start, you're going to. There's a movie called, I believe it's Inc., INC. Judd Hirsch, I believe, is the main actor. And in is a top executive. And she had just left with the guy. Judd Hirsch's character is the son of a senator. So they hire him in order to get certain appropriations for their company. And she's standing in the doorway and she tells him, "You strive all your life to get power. And once you have the power, you forget the reason why you wanted the power in the first place." And so it just becomes a self-feeding beast.
And also, there's that. I had this other theory that the other thing is once they're in power, it's the fear of losing power.
Well, that becomes a part of it, but I think it's more the fear that somebody's going to be able to take it away from you. You want to talk history, in World War I, Lord Haig, I hate to pick on the Brits on
No,
this one,
it's all good.
but during the Boer War, he actually turned colonels in. He would see something they did, and he would immediately report it to the government. And that's how he rose up through the ranks. So, and then of course, he marries into the royal family, and he's the supreme commander for the British forces on the Western Front. And he allowed no dissension whatsoever. He makes a decision. Anybody wants to contradict him or give him a counterpoint, he slams them and would actually eliminate people off his staff. Because he knew how he got to that position. Last thing he wanted was anyone doing the same thing to him. So it creates a paranoia in you when, and he's just an example. It's so many people. I mean, in our own government, you can look at it that way in the US. How did you get to power? You're going to then do everything you can to keep somebody doing the same thing to you.
Because
Yes,
you know
you're
how dirty they were, and how ruthless they were to get there, and how
right.
ambitious they were. It's interesting going back to something you said about the book where they set the fake border, but ultimately they're trying to discover what order were you given, and the order the admiral was given is don't let them know where Earth is. But of
Right.
course, there's this whole, well, if you trust us, what's the problem? Well, yeah, of course I trust you. So, and
Well,
it.
and that is interesting. You're right. And in the negotiation, you're doing that. And they do talk about trust in the negotiation. And the Comoricans do bring up that point. And I forget if it was the Admiral or Michael Shea, the diplomat, who said trade is a form of trust and will build trust. So let's do a trade. And the Comoricans are like, "No, I want to know." But in the book, I explain how the lack of trust, because they on their way there, they're experiencing different encounters with other aliens, and it's not turning out quite like they were hoping. So they actually send out their recon teams, their SEAL teams, onto the planet to get more information. And they
Because this
start
is,
getting some feedback about this.
yeah, because this is that dilemma, isn't it, between idealists and pragmatists? The pragmatist, even on the opposing side, would say, you're right not to trust us. But
Right.
the idealist would say, why don't you trust us?
Right. And a pragmatist or a realist will turn it around on the idealist.
They would. They'd just say no. You know, but if you were negotiating with a realist would actually tell you, you're right not to trust me. You know nothing about me. Trust has to be earned. But the idealist would be, well, how do we move forward and have this relationship of trust if you won't take a leap of faith?
Exactly. And be it on our planet or with first contact, how do you do this without a misstep and inadvertently shooting each other?
It's difficult. What made you decide not to have them as humanoids, the Gamorreans? The reason I ask is because it's a really simple one to do.
Yeah, it'd be too much like us.
Okay.
I mean, I'm already mirroring an alien to our planet and how I view all the countries, you know. So I'm already doing that, but I didn't want to make the, well, like Star Trek, how many of the aliens are humanoids?
I think
the
all
original
of them.
series, well, no, only a few, the Horda, and then there's a planet with a living rock creature. But outside of that, Spock makes the comment about how strange it seems, and I'm paraphrasing, how humanoid or the large percentage of humanoids in the galaxy.
Well, I was going to say, because that's a good point, because even in Star Trek The Next Generation, where they meet Q, who is actually effectively a living god, he presents himself as human.
Yes.
Not as a god.
Well, and he presents it for their understanding. Yeah, and I'm forgetting what movie in the past 10 years or so. The alien or the being says, I'm presenting myself in a form you can understand.
Is that the one when the world stood still with Keanu Reeves?
Not the one I'm thinking, but it could be because
I remember that phrase now.
Yeah. But it wasn't from The Day the Earth Stood Still with Keanu Reeves. But no, actually, my description of the Gamorreans will feed really well into the next two books because I play off of their, for those who haven't read, they're a three-legged being with a torso with four limbs, two tentacles and two arms with eight digits. So it is a totally different creature and body method. And I play off of that in the later books more. But again, it's one of those, I wanted the humans to come across something that they're not shocked when they see them because of what they've already encountered on their way. And if as you go through the book, you'll find humanoid-type creatures, but then you'll find other creatures that really aren't humanoid. Yeah. Like at the first space station, there's a four-legged creature with, I believe, four arms, but he's encased all in metal armor.
Okay. So, I just quickly did a Google search, but I can't find the film that quotes that line. But because I, as soon as you said it, I've heard that line. I can't remember where either. Because it's much more difficult though to go down that. But I suppose you can explore the imagination more.
Well, right, and one of the SEALs, Navy U.S. Navy SEALs, who's on the planet, he comments in his own head how freaky the Gamorreans are to them, especially their hands. He just can't get over the way they operate their fingers, their digits. Yeah. It's bad enough for them that they have tentacles, but these hands really are freaking them out.
Because how much, you know, because you mentioned the interest in the 1950s sci-fi.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things about 1950s sci-fi and possibly the 60s that I don't think has ever been achieved since, it is one, the trailers, you know, those type of B-movie trailers, but also the film posters, the movie posters. Do you know what I mean? Because if that's something that influenced you growing up, then you've got, this is what I'm saying. So you've kind of got all of that, because we never had sci-fi until, what was it, the 40s, the 50s, that sci-fi started becoming a thing? You know?
I mean, Jules Verne had his novels earlier than that, but really, when you talk about the movies, it's after World War II, in essence, or even when were the first ones? Well, yeah, Creature from the Black Lagoon.
That's the one that was the first thing that popped into my head.
Right, but then you have the giant ants ones, the movie called Them. And then you do have, I'm blanking on his name. He did Time Machine, I believe, and War of the Worlds, where Orson Welles narrated it.
Mm.
And that was post-World War II. But
because the interesting thing about that sci-fi and to do with films, especially from, you know, because of that era, because said that there is just the excitement as a kid when you see these posters. But they did something, and films are the only thing that I'm aware of that does this really well, but especially did it really, really well back then. Because you might not like reading sci-fi, but you'd fall in love with watching it.
Well, and thankfully, which is, again, U.S. Review of Books actually says, in my novel, I get to actually draw you in. And Kirkus Reviews called it captivating. U.S. Review likened it to Independence Day.
It's not bad company.
Chapter two is laying out the fleet and the people and so forth. So I would say that's the slow chapter. But after that, you start encountering and seeing what's going on, how the Marines respond, how the rest of the Space Force responds, how the ships have to respond. I bring in my military background and our operational side, because I was on the plans and operations side in my career. So I really put that into those battle scenes. So you see it. But one reason why I really focused more on the 1950s, and be it the books or the shows that I grew up with and watching, technology. I don't go with, even Star Trek, the original series had phasers and different things you could do with phasers. I don't have that level of tech. I keep it basically to what we can achieve today. Rail guns, hypersonic missiles, of course, nukes and lasers, all of which we can do.
That keeps the old bosses happy. Well done.
Yeah. I mentioned electronic warfare because it's a real thing we can do today. So it's everything that we can do. So now they don't just push a button, enemies start to fall away. Now the ships have to work together. The commanders have to work together. You see some of that in the book, is what they're doing. I mean, in chapter one, the very first paragraph, I open up with the space battle and what's going on with that. So
just catching up on something you just said, because you did the operations and planning in, were you naval?
Yes. I'm a retired Navy officer, 28 years, deployed twice with the U.S. Marine Corps in support of them. One in, I think I said 97 before, but 1998, I floated with the 15th MEU on the Essex Amphibious Readiness Group, three ships going out. In fact, we got stuck in the Persian Gulf because the ambassador to Kuwait was nervous about Saddam Hussein. And we were leaving the Persian Gulf and he called us back in. And so an ambassador has a lot of power over even military units.
I didn't
After
know that.
all, oh yeah, they work directly for the president, and combatant commanders work directly for the president. And not that a ambassador can give tactical orders to a military unit. They can give broad enough orders that fit what we do and when and how. As the commanders will always be in charge. And then when I was assigned to 1st Marine Division, I was deployed to Iraq in 2006 for 1 year. So, but the rest of the time, I've either been, well, over 15 years, I was joint, which meant I worked on staffs that had all the services.
Yeah.
And I planned for operations and worked with the leadership on overseeing those operations.
Because one of the things, and I'm imagining this is something you allow to play out a lot in the book, and you have said as much, is but the difference is you're possibly drawing on real life experience in the sense of you're aware that there's a potential situation and there's going to be like, you know, like a discussion. You're trying to lead the Persian Gulf. The ambassador says, actually, we've got a problem. Kuwait is feeling nervous. We need you to go back. So at that point, there's probably the pragmatic view that, or the realistic view, nothing's going to happen. However, if it does, how are we going to respond? And at what point do we allow them to press up against a boundary before we push back? Because there's always going to be that. Because that's really often when a conflict can be started or avoided. Do you know what I mean? That there is some, and I'm talking layman's terms, so you can all kind of allow me some tether to play about with and hang myself with. But that there's a little element of like, you know, like the famous scene in almost every naval picture or a film, fire a shot across the bows, let them know what they're messing about with. And that's really pushing back against the boundaries. Like, you guys have got a bit too close. We think you're just testing the water, no pun intended. But we're going to show you exactly what the consequence of that is if you don't take the opportunity to leave.
Right. So it's called deterrence. And after the 1984 Beirut incident, and it's one of the few times to actually go down the line you were talking about. A couple of admirals went ashore and they were placed in jeopardy. And that allowed our battleship, when we still floated our battleships, to fire some rounds at certain targets. And then the president told, no, stop that. But a good deterrence for a lot of the littoral or countries that have a coastline is for an armed MEU to show up, because that tells them there's Marines out there and they're seen. They let themselves be seen. And that tells them there's Marines out there ready to come ashore and cause havoc in my country. And another deterrent is for a U.S. aircraft carrier to show up and start flying their fighter jets around. They're out there to be seen in order to say, you do anything more than what you're doing, we will create havoc in your country. And
because that's what I'm saying about the planning and operations. The operation is, and I'm assuming, right? But the operation is we're going to display deterrence. But the plan is, this is what we'll do if you don't listen.
Right. And I actually kind of touch on that in the book. The first space station they come up across, they go through the planning. I don't go into any detail of the planning because a military planning process, while for me is enjoyable, and a lot of people in my field, I can see how readers would be like, what? But the operations officer, Captain Lindsay, she's briefing the commander and deputy commander. And they just kind of tell her, hey, relax, you've done enough. As General Eisenhower, you say planning is important, but only to learn how to deal with contingencies, how to plan, learn the process, but don't get wrapped up in the planning. You know, and I paraphrase the general and the president rather poorly, but that's in essence, planning is important, but don't fall in love with the plan.
Yeah.
When they're going into Camorra proper, they're saying they're having a debate. How do we show up? You know, we have seven ships. Do we just land on their doorstep? Do we piecemeal it in? And they come to a decision about how to jump into their home world. And, you know, it is, if you're sitting there and you think about it, suddenly you have a fleet of ships appear where you can see them,
yeah,
and you're not expecting them. What do you do? You know, what does this mean?
when the planning and operations happen, because I'm going to imagine there's common misconceptions in the sense that I might say, right, you know, because I've got zero experience in this field, well, I think we should maybe get ready to target X, Y, and Z. And you might say, no, you don't need to do that. We just need to fly some planes about. They'll get the message. And I'll be like, oh, right. Why is that? So, but like you're saying, but if you go into too much detail, it becomes boring, right? Because people might not like it the way that you have a passion for it, right? But you're kind of already, you have this kind of wealth of experience of how the chess games play out. And I'm guessing, especially as you're part of, US Navy, and as you mentioned, well, actually, if an aircraft carrier turns up, it makes people think, all right, yeah, maybe we'll just calm things down a little bit. Everyone, party's over, turn the lights down, turn the music off. Do you know what I mean? Mum and dad have turned up. We're not in trouble, but we're going to get grounded if we're not careful, right? And right. It's a big leveler. But what I'm wondering is, because where these things become an issue, which is effectively where I imagine the book goes, is what is their capability versus our capability? So that's very different planning and operations. But you can't, like you said, you can't get into the nitty gritty with that because people won't have the same level of understanding and passion with it as you did. So how did you navigate that?
Part of what you go off of in real life is your intel, and you really try to delve into the capability of your near peer or a non-governmental entity, a terrorist group. What are their capabilities? What do they have? What are they missing? Well, they, in the book, they don't know that. So I actually had the Comorricans do a response. And when it becomes a fight for survival, the humans, while trying to get away without going back to Earth, because they can't lead the Comorricans to Earth, they're trying to figure out how are they able to do what they're doing and how do we shake them? How do we get rid of them? And they come up with a couple ingenious ideas, in my opinion, of doing that and how to get rid of them. But they run into a problem is, through hyperspace, they're being tracked and followed, which is baffling to their scientists, because I also am sure there's a science cadre as part of the fleet, and they're trying to figure it all out. And the admiral finally makes a decision where it buys them some time to figure out what the Comorgans were doing. And then he comes up with a plan to neutralize that capability so he can try his best to save this fleet. They run to Earth, which then violates all the rules, or B, he destroys his entire fleet. He self-sacrifices it or self-destructs it, or he just runs off into the far distance, hoping to outlast the chase, the pursuers. But I do show the response of the Comorgans in a couple of different ways to it, because, again, they have no intel. And chapter six is one where, one, I show the military way of thinking, because the Admiral wants a brief before they get to Comorica. He wants everybody put back on the same level playing ground, remind them of their mission, why they're out there. And he's not really happy with the information he gets. But it affects their planning. It tells them, I have so many unknowns, I just have to make assumptions.
Yeah.
And we have to do our best not to get shot at when we appear in their space. But then
that's generally pretty good advice. Don't get shot at.
Right. So when they appear, you know, they're in a contingency mindset.
Yeah.
But they're also in a diplomatic mindset. And the Comorgans respond the way the Comorgans respond. So
I just getting closer to just sort of finishing up. One of the things I wanted to know a little bit about, and we kind of touched on it earlier when I mentioned about the 1950s, 60s sci-fi movies and the books that you obviously read, and how much of it is there when you're doing this writing and you're talking about SESG Explorer, how much of it is there a 10-year-old boy who's bursting at the seams to get all of this imagination out? And then how much of it is this man who served 28 years in planning and operations that says, calm down, that's not how things work?
It's interesting. As I tell people when I'm doing book events or shows or book signing, I'm just writing and the story's coming out. I let it free flow. I do a outline. I do some character development, and my main characters, I do some history to them. And I check that when I'm writing it, I'll check it, but pretty much I'm just writing. And a couple of characters, one is a Marine gunnery sergeant. I never planned on him. And he appeared, and I'm writing him. And before I know it, he dies. I had no idea he was going to die. He just dies. And of course, the way he dies is, in my mind, heroic. And it is what a gunnery sergeant would do in combat. And it's really when I get into the editing portion that I'm more calm and thinking my way through it. And especially in the second book, I have a really heavy ground battle with the Marines and a soldier, an army unit against hostile aliens. And I really had to think the way through it. I had to go back and do some casualty estimations, all that, fall back to my military career in order to try and figure out, okay, how do I, in the end, how do they talk about where they're at? How do they get to the point? But in trying to describe the battles, I did that in SESG Explorer, I think, pretty well. I did it pretty good, I think, in Minerva, but I really had to think about how would the ships maneuver in like a serial grab, because they can do all three-dimensional moving, C, X, and Y axis. So I really had to think my way through about how to do that, keep them in proper formation. The fighters, again, I'm not a naval aviator, not a pilot, but I've been around enough of that community to know about formation and formation flying.
Yeah.
And then how will you use them? Is anytime they came out of hyperspace, the Admiral immediately launched what we call a cap, just small formation of fighters flying around to make sure nothing's approaching. So all that. So long-winded answer, but free-flowing. And then during editing, I start to pull back and try to make sure the sequencing is correct and not something that would be too fantastic, I would say.
Because it's difficult, because I think of the film Men in Black. And on one hand, when you actually think about it, there's quite a few characters that are not humanoid, even if they present themselves as humanoid. And one of the things that the writers of that film did exceptionally well is there was no human technology. All of the technology was borrowed from other races.
Right.
And they get this balance, pretty good, of races that are really, really good. And then there's races that want to take over the earth and kill it and enslave it. And, you know, and they have some very strange aliens. I can't remember which one it is, but you've got that massive thing that goes through the tube stations and lives in the underground. Right. And that's what I'm saying, because they got that incredible balance of, oh, we'll sneak in technology from other aliens and we don't have to come up with how we discovered it. We'll let our imagination play out with some crazy creatures. So there is that little 10-year-old running around and who's kind of, I want the story to be this, and I want him to go super fast, and I want the car to fly upside down and go really hyperdrive and fly. Right. But they're borrowing technology. It's not theirs, even though they made it a 1960s car. But then they play practical things like, well, this is how aliens think. This is how people think. They're after this weapon and stuff like that. Because, and that's what I mean. How much of the little boy, because you said something quite important. You didn't use any technology that doesn't already exist to your knowledge. Right, so it's effectively you're playing with your own experience, but doing the opposite. You're taking it off planet Earth, and you're putting it in the future, outside in space.
Right.
So which bit is the 10-year-old, and which bit is the 28 years serving officer? Because did you see what I mean? Did you see what I'm saying? Like, everyone else brings aliens to Earth and then uses their technology. You've effectively left Earth, become an alien, but keeping Earth technology.
Right. And actually, in the book, they come across technology. And that's one of their, they're given, as when the Admiral's getting his orders, you know, go meet the Comorgans and establish diplomatic relations and possibly a trade deal. And, oh, by the way, explore along the way, which is like 1800s orders to a Navy captain and the days of sail. You know, you're going out there. You can't talk to us, but here's your broad orders. And so the Admiral determines with the scientists, find new technology and see if we can incorporate it into our tech. And they find new energy sources along the way in order to improve their hyperdrive and their weapon systems and scanning systems. But the 10-year-old would be the story itself.
Okay.
The 28-year veteran is more of, all right, let's tap it down and see how we can improve the systems. How would a bridge crew work, or how would a admiral staff work on a far distant mission?
So would it be like it's a 10-year-old story with a 28-year-old veteran's infrastructure?
Well, I don't know if I would say it quite that way. Definitely the 28-year veteran structure, but the 10-year-old was just awoken. But I think the story is far more advanced than that because I am showing the military and how it works. For instance, there's a discussion between the CAG and the deputy commander about why the new admiral, because they had a general who was relieved for cause, and the admiral was brought in, and the colonel is having this serious discussion with the deputy commander as to why, and why the deputy commander wasn't just fleeted up to be the commander of the fleet. And that's has nothing to do with youth. That has everything to do with how organizations work and leadership
So
works.
how much of it then could it almost be may autobiography in the but not that's the wrong context, but it's literally like, hey guys, I've got some stories to tell about things I've seen, but just so that nobody gets upset, nobody tries to assume that it was in the Persian Gulf or whatever, I can put it in space. But by the way, this is what happened in real life.
Yeah, no, that's exactly it. Even my wife is like, when I describe the in chapter one and chapter two, the briefing room, she's like, that's the way it really is, because she worked for the Department of the Army at U.S. Africa Command when I was stationed there in Stuttgart, Germany, and she saw the briefing rooms that I was describing and the way. The mannerisms of the different officers and the way they behave, from a junior officer to a senior officer. I was considered a senior officer, but not a flag officer or a general officer, because I wasn't. I retired as a Navy commander. So I'm senior, not junior, but I rose up through the ranks and I worked around general officer and flag officers and noticed their mannerisms. And at the War College, we even discussed about what would get a commander relieved for cause. And at Seventh Fleet, Admiral Willard, who was my admiral at the time, he was Seventh Fleet, he relieved another admiral for cause. And that's actually in the book. Not that incident, well, kind of that incident. But unless you were there at the time I was there, you don't even know who I'm talking about, because all of the militaries have this problem. We get general and flag officers who forget their roles at times. And well, I just recently read about a lieutenant colonel in the Marine Corps being relieved of his command. But it just says for cause. It won't tell you what that is. Why was the lieutenant colonel relieved? But then what do you do? And that's a leadership point that you only know about in your adult life and your encounters, be it a business or a military or a government.
Because that's got to be incredibly difficult. And I definitely don't understand how it works. I don't know if actually a lower ranking officer can relieve a higher ranking officer of duty, even if he has good cause. I don't know if that's actually possible.
Well, in my actually these the one incident that I was close to, it was a 3-star relieving a 1-star. So
So it was rank, he could effectively pull rank.
And he had the authority to do it. It's not just necessarily rank. There is cases where a lower ranking officer could relieve a higher ranking one, but you're getting real dangerous on getting court-martialed for doing that.
Because you've also just mentioned something that's quite important, which just reminded me of there's a difference between your authority and your rank. And sometimes, especially because of the infrastructure of the military and the Navy and the Air Force, is so huge that even within the same kind of institutions, you might have a higher rank, but somebody else in a who's a lower rank but in a higher position of authority. And the one that always springs to mind, and I don't know if it's the same in America, we have sergeant majors in the UK in regiments, but you also have somebody called the garrison sergeant major, who's in charge of all of the entire area. And he would typically be under the brigadier. So you might be the captain, the major, or the lieutenant, but this garrison sergeant major will only answer to the brigadier. So you outrank him, but don't think he's going to take an order from you.
I actually had that. It's called rank inversion. When I had my company, my first time with the Marines, I had a company and I had sailors and Marines working for me. I'm an 03, a lieutenant in the Navy. I could give orders to a Navy captain, which is like a colonel. If he or she is assigned to my unit and I'm the company commander, but they're of higher rank, I'm the one with all the authority, not that person. Do I respect their rank? Yes. Do I respect their skill set? Of course. Would I salute them? Yes. But when it comes to the company, they do what I command because I was the commanding officer of that unit. And it's rank inversion. Marines have real difficulty with it, and they rarely put themselves in that situation. But the Navy, we do it a lot. I'm not sure if I think the Air Force does it too. Army, the infantry units would avoid it like the plague.
Definitely.
Because you really are talking about certain technical skills and authorities. And I've seen Army majors that won't make a decision without first going and talking to the Army colonel, the one in charge of their unit. You're here in my planning session to make decisions, but you're telling me you won't do it. It really baffled me because in the Navy, we always said whoever you send has to be able to make decisions. And we would send lieutenants, 03s, into a meeting where the Army would send in full bird colonels. Our lieutenant would be in there making decisions, and the colonel would be making their decisions. But they wouldn't send in a corresponding rank to our lieutenants. Our lieutenants' skill sets would match what the mission or objectives were. And that's the thing to recognize about some of the militaries of ranks. Is it the rank or the expertise you're after? And that's where it gets convoluted. I avoid a lot of that in the book. I keep a lot of the rank structure appropriate for the sequence of events. But yeah, I didn't want to get into those complexities of real life military. That's why you have the 3-star admiral with the 2-star general, and then all the commanding officers are 06s, be they Navy captains or Space Force slash Air Force colonels. And I made all of them 06s because it's an exploratory first contact. If something happens to the admiral and the general, they needed to be a sufficient rank and experience to take over. And there's actually, I don't go into the chain of command structure in the book, but there definitely is a chain of command structure, though, within SESG Explorer. So,
So, lastly, just to finish, because this is the first book of a trilogy, the second one is being written. So, I'm assuming there's at least a concept of what the third one will be like. What's going to win out, idealism or realism?
So, in fact, I got to go on to my website, ChristopherLorick.com, and update that I just got cleared by DOD for publication. And I have to re-edit two chapters, and then I'm sending it to a publisher. But, and I already have an outline for the third book. And I've been working out a couple of different chapters. In fact, you're going to see more of the Comorgans in the third book and their thinking pattern. So what's going to win out, idealism or realism? I think you're going to see a mixture of those. I can't really say right now in the last book. I mean, I'm even thinking about an epilogue to the last book that plays really to that very question. Yeah. I'm not totally satisfied with that.
Well, here's my two pence worth. Because, like you say, it plays on with the Comorgans and stuff, and the slavery issue, and how that comes about and stuff. Mm-hmm. Slavery was realism; it was idealism that ended it. But it took realism to achieve it.
It did. I know George Washington hated having slaves, but he couldn't just set them free without first educating them and giving them money so they knew how to deal with it. The UK, I think France, and definitely the US, when we created our first six frigates, we sent them to the west coast of Africa to stop the transport of slaves. And your country had a big role in stopping the slave trade out West Africa.
Well, we made it illegal across the empire, across the Commonwealth,
Well, at that time, it was the empire.
But it nearly bankrupted Great Britain. And it cost us about a third of the Navy, 50% of the Navy. It was the fighting, you know, using our, you know, because, you know, there's a famous song called Royal Britannia, Britannia Rules the Waves. Well, Britannia nearly ended up boatless.
Wow. It is. I mean, and Charles Gordon, is his first name Charles? Chinese Gordon, General Gordon, he actually single-handedly stopped the slave trade in the Sudan. And it destroyed their economy to the point that you had rise of the Mahdi and two different ethnic groups. He led them and really was causing the Egyptian protectorate of the empire great problems. And Gordon died in Khartoum trying to stop the Mahdi and what he was doing. Our countries have had a lot of efforts in stopping the slave trade. And I do address a little bit of it in SCSG Explorer. In Minerva, it's just an undertone because of what the humans are trying to do. You only see the Comorgans once in Minerva. But Minerva is more anti-piracy, which we'll deal with. If you end piracy, you'll also end slavery. So that's just kind of, one could say, a benefit of fighting against piracy. But always, what's the consequence? And I do explore consequences in Explorer and Minerva. And the last book, you'll see that too. And that's why I say it's a tension between realism and idealism. I may have to totally agree with you that idealism stopped that portion of the slave trade in the 1800s. But how much of it dealt with the Barbary Coast? To me, that wasn't anti-piracy. That wasn't actually a war between Western Europe, the United States, and the Northern African countries.
Well, because you made a very good point, and this is that it took idealism, but it took realism to push it through. Because, as you mentioned, the ideal, which we all agree with, but it took realism because it crushed another country's economy.
Right. And it actually, you go from Libya all the way to Morocco. We had to defeat all those countries in order to stop their practices of slavery, because they would make raids, and the Ottoman Empire would make raids all the way to Ireland for slaves.
Yeah, yeah.
So that took a lot of effort, too, a lot of ships and manpower.
This is it.
In the end, it took a world war.
And that's exactly what it took. That is exactly what it took. So, but that's been brilliant. I thoroughly enjoyed this. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you. I appreciate it. It's been enjoyable for me too.
So there you have it. That was my conversation with Christopher about the SESG Explorer. I hope you liked the conversation. He and I had a little chat afterwards. An amazing guy. I loved chatting to him. Really, so much energy. It was brilliant. So please do check out his website. The link will be in the description. Look for the book. It will be out soon. And as always, wherever you are, whatever you believe, please take care of yourself. Thank you very much for tuning in and listening. Be blessed. Take care.